So we started a new series last week called Won't You Be a Neighbor? And I told you it was based on, you know, my childhood experience watching Mr. Rogers. I found a quote from him this week that really spoke to me. He said this: when we look for what's best in the person that we happen to be with at the moment, we are doing what God does. So in appreciating our neighbor, we are participating in something truly sacred. I think that's pretty profound. I think he was on to something by correlating how we treat others, neighbors, to something sacred or holy. Today, we're going to move right ahead in this series, but what we're going to do while we move ahead in the series, we're actually going to go back in the scripture, because last week, we started this series by looking at Luke chapter 10 and how Luke gives us the account that Jesus has with this expert in the law, where the expert in the law challenges Jesus, you know, and the question was like, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus says, well, you know the law. What does it say? And he answers, well, it says, love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, well, you've answered correctly. Now go and do this. And the guy says, oh, but who's my neighbor? Like, I got to know who to love, right? And Jesus gives us this, you know, maybe it's a parable, maybe it's a story. It's certainly possible that it really happened about the fellow who had been beaten up and left for dead on the side of the road, and two religious people and one person that would have been considered an enemy see this guy, and it's the enemy, the hated person that is the neighbor. And Jesus says, you need to be like him, like the person you hate. Go be like him. And so the big point from the sermon last week, just as a reminder for those of you that were here and for those of you that weren't here, here's the catch-up point. Christ calls us to draw close in a world that is increasingly closed off. So this is my cue to advance the slides, but here's one thing I've already noticed that I hate about this. Every time my phone goes to sleep, I have to log back in. So this is not going to work for me. At all. Whoa, there we go. There it is. So you might just sit back there and help me out, because I'm not going to log in every time. And if Tyler's watching on Facebook, Tyler, I think I told you this before, the beta thing, they need to do some more research. All right. So I want you to turn with me to Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19. And what we find in Leviticus chapter 19 is this is a section of the Old Testament where God is instructing his people, Israel, how to be neighbors and why being a neighbor was so important. So what we see in this portion of the Old Testament is God gave his people specific instructions they were expected to follow in their time and in their context. So when we look at these writings in the Old Testament, there are going to be times that we read some of these laws, some of these instructions that seem kind of odd to us because our culture and our context is completely different. However, there are some principles that back these laws, and it's the principles behind these specific instructions that I believe transcend time and transcend culture. And so when we look back to the Old Testament, it's not that the Old Testament is not pertinent to our lives. It's that we have to do a little digging. We have to figure out what exactly is the principle behind this specific law, right? So just for example, one of the laws, if you read through Deuteronomy, you'll find that one of the laws is don't boil a goat in its mother's milk. All right, well, what in the world is, I mean, what in the world does that really mean? Well, you can do some digging and figure out the principle behind it. This book of Leviticus, you know, before we dig into the text, the name Leviticus actually comes from like the Latin or the Greek influenced word that means pertaining to the Levites. So the majority of this book, the majority of Leviticus was written to priests and Levites. Now, think about that for a moment, because I think this is fascinating. Because if you remember last week, the two gentlemen that were walking along the road that passed up the guy that needed help, one was a priest and one was a Levite. And Jesus listens to this gentleman, quote, from the book of Leviticus. And so we see Jesus, you know, uses an encounter here that The guy quoted directly from a book that was written about or to priests and Levites, pertaining to how they function in the temple, how what it looks like for them to be holy. Now, inside of this book written to priests and Levites, there are sections, there are chunks that apply to every person in Israel. And that's where we're going to fall today. We're going to fall in one of those sections in a chapter that doesn't just pertain to priests and Levites. It pertains to all Israelites, all people who would have been considered God's people. And this section outlines how they're expected to treat others. All right, what you're going to find when we dig into this is that the expert in the law quoted this, and then a section of this writing we're going to read is quoted also a couple times in Leviticus itself, and then Peter quotes this in his letter in the New Testament. So let's look at chapter 19, verses 1 and 2, and then 9 and 10. So keep this in mind as we read this. This is a book written to a group of people that had just gained independence from being held captive in slavery for 400 years. All right, so get this in your mindset. This people, they had been in a foreign country, influenced by a foreign culture, influenced by foreign gods, foreign practices for 400 years. All right. And they are getting ready to inhabit a land whose culture and beliefs look completely different than theirs. And so God is setting up expectations for a new society of people. This is what this is about. He's saying here, basically, this is what it looks like for people who have been set apart for my purpose to live. This is what it looks like. And so this is where it pertains to us. He sets them apart the same way that the church is set apart today. Right now, I don't think the church is like the new Israel, but to some degree, there's a lot of parallels. And one of those parallels is that the church today is the group of people that God has set apart for his purpose. Not America, not any other nation. It's the church. The church is the group of people God has set apart. All right, so here we go. Leviticus chapter 19, verses 1 and 2. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the entire assembly of Israel and say to them, 'Be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy.'" Now, this right here, that "be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy," that is the theme of the entire book of Leviticus. You go back to chapter 11, verse 44, you'll find it there again. And this is what Peter quotes in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 15 and 16. To the New Testament people, "Be holy, for I am holy." Now, if you skip down to verses 9 and 10, "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God." All right. So like, what in the world is going on here? We are right. Well, some guys are finishing up. Some guys are right in the heart of harvest. And I don't see very many fields where the corners have been left untouched. Like they're getting the whole thing, right? Bunch of lawbreakers. I think here's some principles that are very important for us to take away from this. The first principle is this, and I think this is one that we often overlook. How we neighbor is directly related to being holy. This is how the chapter starts. This is the theme of the book. Be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. How we neighbor is directly related to being holy. The goal for God's people does not change from the Old Testament to the New Testament. The goal for God's people is exactly the same throughout the entire scriptures. You've probably heard me say this before, but I'm going to say it again. The first time we took Abby to church camp and she stayed overnight for a significant period of time, we got off away from the camp onto 44 headed home, And I asked her, I was like, Abby, what did you learn this week at church camp? And her answer floored me. Her answer floored me because she was very young at the time, and it's really some of the, it's something that I still struggle with, and it's something that all of you still struggle with to this day. Like, this is what she said. Dad, this is what I learned this week. God does not want us to be happy. He wants us to be holy. God does not want us to be happy. He wants us to be holy. And this is what this is pointing to. This text, this book says, be holy because I am holy. And so being a neighbor is directly related to holiness. See, culture tells us to pursue happiness. Culture tells us that if you're not happy, something is wrong with your life. God tells us to pursue holiness. And here's what we have to understand. We will only ever attain happiness if we first pursue holiness. You'll never reach happiness if you don't start with holiness. And to be holy, it's not that hard of a concept to wrap our minds around. To be holy, all it means is to be set apart, to be different. And in the Old Testament specifically, to be holy meant that you were set apart for service to God. So it would happen to people and things could be considered holy. If you read through the Old Testament, you'll find that there were holy people that served in the temple. There were holy utensils that were used in the temple. And the utensils had to be treated a certain way. Certain things had to be done because they were set apart for service to God. So when we think about holiness in our context, and specifically in church culture today, there is the temptation to equate holiness to thinking of just avoiding certain things. Well, if we don't do certain things, if we don't say certain words, we don't go certain places, then that's being holy. And sometimes that is part of holiness. But really, the thrust, the big part of holiness that we sometimes miss is holiness is about doing certain things. And this is the specific point in this section of Leviticus that we read today. Like, be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And then do this, like, as you're out there reaping those fields, harvesting those fields, leave the corners. Do those things because it impacts your own holiness. Not only does it help people who need it, but it impacts your holiness. Gary Niehoff, I came across this comment this week that he made. People want an alternative to culture, not an echo. And he was talking about the church. And this relates to holiness. He said, people want an alternative to culture, not an echo. What is he saying? People want the church to be holy, to be set apart, to be different. They don't want to come into a church and expect to encounter the same thing they encounter outside of the church. And this is what God was doing for these people of Israel when he set up the law. He was offering them a way of life that looked different from how they had experienced it in Egypt and how they were going to experience it in Canaan. And so some of those laws where we scratch our head and we're like, well, man, that really doesn't make sense. Well, it's because it was directly related to something that happened in Egypt. He said, avoid that, or something they were going to encounter in Canaan. Don't avoid this and do this. So alternative way of life, alternative way of living so that people know you are set apart for God's specific purpose. That's what holiness is. And this is where we have an opportunity as the church today, God's people today. We can offer an alternative culture. And a piece of that culture, that alternative culture, a piece of looking different is how being a neighbor relates to holiness. In other words, how we treat other people should be one of the things that sets us apart from the rest of the world, the culture around us. So how we neighbor is directly related to being holy. Here's the second thing, I think, principle that we get from this section of text. Part of being holy is moving others toward wholeness. Part of being holy is moving others toward wholeness. So all these guys out here during the harvest right now, they're not leaving the corners of the fields. I was just kidding. They're not really lawbreakers. So hopefully they made it this far in the Facebook and they're like, oh, we're shutting it off now. You're not lawbreakers. The principle behind this is part of being holy is moving others toward holiness. That's what we see in that principle. Leave the corners of the fields. Don't go over your vineyard a second time. Why? What was going on? Listen, we don't practice agriculture the same way today. We just don't do it. We don't live in an agrarian society. We might live in an agricultural setting, but we are not an agrarian society like these people did. But here's the common thread. We encounter poverty. We encounter poverty in our own community. And definitely we encounter poverty when we get outside of this country and the rest of the world. Now, here's what I want to challenge you with this morning. What is poverty? When you think of poverty, what do you think about? What comes to your mind? If you would do a poll and ask someone or a group of people, what is poverty? Many of those people would describe it as lacking something material. Now, if you go to a group of people who are in poverty and you ask them what poverty is, they would tell you that poverty is a mindset. It's not an actual lack of something material, but it's a mindset that they have. So when we look at poverty from a biblical perspective, I would say that the root of all poverty is brokenness. The root of all poverty is brokenness. It's a direct result of sin. When sin entered the world became a broken place. And because the world is broken, we experience poverty. We encounter poverty. And so being a neighbor means that we should strive to empower the impoverished. This is how we serve others. This is what it looks like to be a neighbor. So there's a two-phase approach that I think the church should consider when we think about addressing poverty. And I think to some degree, we do one part really well and we do one part really poorly. So here's the two-part approach to addressing poverty. First, there is the relief phase of meeting needs. Relief means meeting immediate needs, and relief should be temporary in nature. So when we think about relief, it often focuses on meeting physical needs like food, water, shelter. And I think to some degree, the church does an okay job at this, right? I'll tell you one of the things that there's a church in Connersville that does this part of this so well, Cross Point Biker Church. If you think of a church that provides relief, Cross Point Biker Church is a relief church because anytime they hear of any type of natural disaster, they load up semis and people and they travel wherever it is and they provide food. I mean, that's their mission. That's their goal. And they do a really good job at that, an extremely good job at that. They've been all over the U.S. They've served, I'd say, tens of thousands of meals to people in need. The second phase of this, however, is restoration. This is where we fail. This is where the majority of churches in the United States fail. We focus so much on relief, we forget about restoration. Restoration is long-term. Restoration is the hard stuff. It's the messy stuff. It's not quick. It's not short-term. Restoration focuses on building relationships with people that help address a physical need, but also address a mental and a spiritual need. Right? If we rush into a situation and we provide food, we're meeting an immediate need, but we're not addressing the brokenness. We're not addressing the root cause of the problem. And remember that these physical needs are often symptoms of a deeper problem. The deeper problem is brokenness. It's sin. And Jesus is the only solution to brokenness. Jesus is the only solution to brokenness. You can fill their stomach and their soul still be empty. But when we read these things in Leviticus, what we find is God expects us not only to fill their stomach, but to also fill their soul. We have to address the whole problem. As a community of believers, we should always be looking for ways to provide both relief and restoration to those who are experiencing or living in brokenness. All right, I'm going to get my phone out and see if I can switch to this right now. Give me a second to log back in. I want to see if I can start this video by myself. Slide number 7. Nah, it's junk. Will you start slide number 7, please?
And ever since I was 5 years old, and she continued to invite me to church over and over. And I was unmarried and pregnant at the time, and I didn't want anything to do with church or the God that I remembered being raised under. And she never relented. And so I gave in. And I attended a church service, and the pastor began to speak about Jesus, who was loving and who was kind and merciful and forgiving and who wanted a relationship with me. And I had not heard that before. And something began to happen in my heart. I've belonged to Christ and have not left church since then. When I was younger, I always had a heart for the poor and for the downtrodden or anyone that really felt invisible or overlooked. It's just something that the Lord had placed in my heart was this thread of compassion. In 2009, I believe the Lord gave me a vision for Love Lunch Sack Ministry. I remember Him specifically saying, "Show my love." And what He showed me was a mental picture of a brown paper sack lunch, and it had a red heart on the front of it. And so when the Lord said, "Show my love," I knew that He didn't want me to go to the streets and preach or condemn or judge, but just to be loving, because we're all in need of that. We got together in my home with some friends and put together 50 lunches, and we went out to the street. And I prayed and asked the Lord to lead me in the direction that He wanted me to go, and drove around and had cars following me. We didn't know what to do or how to do it. We were just following the Lord. I remember looking off to my left and seeing a pair of legs in a dumpster. And I got out of my car with a brown sack lunch with a red heart on it and said, "Excuse me, how are you?" And a man pulled his body out of the dumpster and began to wipe himself off. And I said, "Can I bless you today with the lunch?" And I extended my hand to shake his hand. And he said, "Ma'am, you don't want to touch me." He said, "I'm dirty." And I said, "I'm dirty too." And I put my arms around him and I hugged him. That was the first person that I encountered on the street, and I knew that the Lord had done something for sure in my heart and in my life at that moment, and that He was faithful to lead me right where He wanted me. And after I had encountered a couple of people who were experiencing homelessness, I was just broken, quite honestly. I was very broken. Even to this day, I can remember those emotions and meeting those people and how desperate they are for love. We would do this every Sunday for over 2 years, and that number increased from 50 lunches to 300 lunches a Sunday. And then they became to know us by our logo, which was this brown paper bag with a red heart. And we built trustworthy relationships. And so the ministry has expanded quite a bit from just a sack lunch to transitioning people, helping people connect with employers to get work. We are helping them get identification and insurance and to just stabilize them and transition them from the street to everyday living. We have also developed a street church where we're not only feeding them physically, but spiritually the Word of God. I've always just had a heart for those that need love and that need the truth. And I just know what it's like to not have the truth and want love. And so it is my heart's mission, and I believe the goal for God on my life is to extend that to people who may not have it.
I think that's a really good picture of both relief and restoration. So here's some opportunities that I think we have to step into it here at Hands Creek, and Don already stole some of my thunder in his announcements. So many of you know the Sanfords. Gene Sanford's involved with the 4Cs Food Pantry. The 4Cs stands for Christian. There you are back there. I was looking for you over here. Stands for Christian Community Cooperative Closet. And I believe he told me it was started in February of 1988. And some of you have approached me like, why don't we do this here at Hannah's Creek? So Gene and I have met several times, and we have started that process moving forward, what it looks like to partner together and work together. So I want to challenge you, though. Those of you that talked to me, your concern was we need boxes to put food in. That's great. That's relief. But if you were concerned about bringing boxes of food and putting them in boxes, I want to challenge you to volunteer at the food pantry and build relationships with people. See, bringing a box of food's easy. Go there. Meet the people that are in need. Build a relationship with those people. That's the hard part. And that's when we fulfill being a neighbor. So we're going to have these totes. For those of you who say, hey, you know, the restoration thing, maybe I'm just not into that yet. That's fine. Start somewhere. Start with relief. We'll sit one at the front door, one at the back door. We'll collect all of this stuff until November 16th, which is the same time a collection of Operation Christmas Child. So bring your little box back for Christmas Child, and the weeks leading up to it, bring extra non-perishable food items, set it in these boxes. Gene's going to take that to the Four Seas building for their distribution on, I believe it's that day, right? So, and this is in preparation for their Thanksgiving meal give out. So they'll have everything, my understanding is, they'll have everything they need to have a complete Thanksgiving meal. So we certainly want to support that. Another thing I want to put on your radar, November 22nd, this is a tentative time. November 22nd from 5 to 8 p.m., there are a few churches that have begun conversations about a community Thanksgiving dinner. Edwards Memorial has always done a community Thanksgiving dinner at Edwards. They have reached out and asked if other churches would partner with them to do a bigger community dinner at the middle school cafeteria. And they need help. They need not just financial support, but they need people to show up and serve and bring and donate food. As we find out more about this, I will let you know, but I would write that down if you're interested in making food or serving food. Right now they're thinking from 5 to 8 p.m. on November 22nd. All right, I want to transition to our reflection time by reading you this scripture from Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19. And this is Jesus speaking. He goes to the synagogue, and he stood up to read, and he read from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, and this is what he read. And now notice the theming here and how it correlates to what we've talked about today. The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Sometimes I think it's hard for us to relate to those words, because while we may experience some hardships in our life financially, none of us have ever truly been poor in this country. We might have struggled from time to time, but being really poor is hard to identify with. Not many of us in this room have been held captive by a foreign country. Maybe some of you have, but by far the majority of us haven't. So we don't know what it's like to be set free from some kind of prison. But the reality is that when we gather around the Lord's table, it should be a reminder to us that we were all once spiritually poor. We were all impoverished. We lived a life of brokenness. But we can be grateful and we can celebrate this meal together because Jesus' death leads us to wholeness and holiness. His body was broken for our brokenness to be restored. And each time we take this meal together, we are proclaiming that restoration is found in Jesus' broken body and in his shed blood. So today, as you take this, I think some of you struggle with this because you struggle with the weight of maybe sin. But when you understand salvation, you know that the weight of sin has been lifted, not by anything that you have done, but by what he did for you. And so this is a celebration. This is a happy moment to know that while we were enemies, Jesus was a neighbor. And he loved us enough to die for us. So they're going to come up and play a reflection song. I'm going to pray. Rod, would you come up? And Brandon, would you come up? Maybe Jeff, so you can take the sections. At Hannah's Creek, we practice open communion. If you're a professing follower of Jesus, you're more than welcome to share this with us. We double stack the cups. The bottom cup is the bread. The top cup is the blood. I would ask that today we will not take it in unison. So switch it up a little bit, but to do some reflection and to take it when you are ready. After self-inspection, after reflection, take it at your own will. And then at the end, I'll come back up here and we'll conclude with a prayer together.